Welcome back to the deep dive. You know, we like to get into the nitty-gritty, and today is no different, especially for all you law students out there. Sometimes you need to really unpack a concept to wrap your head around it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And well, that's what we're doing today with a deep dive into a New Jersey Supreme Court case. And this case really gets at the heart of a super fundamental legal idea, the duress defense.
Right, right.
So, you know, when can you say, okay, yeah, I did this thing that was against the law, but I was forced to.
Yeah, and I mean, that gets at the heart of what we're looking at today. Under what circumstances can a threat actually excuse what would otherwise be a criminal act? And I think it might seem simple enough at first glance, but as we're going to see when we really dig in, it gets pretty tricky, especially when you start talking about the timing of the threat.
Yeah, absolutely. The timing is really key here, and that's actually what we see play out in the case we're looking at today. We've been looking over excerpts focusing on a New Jersey Supreme Court case.
Yeah.
And for our purposes, let's just call it State v. Defendant.
Perfect.
And this case really gives us a chance to explore, you know, like I was saying, when someone can convincingly argue, hey, I did this, but I was basically forced into it.
Right.
So, you know, what are the legal hurdles someone has to clear to successfully claim duress? Why does the timing of the threat matter so much? And then also, what does all of this tell us about how the law tries to balance holding people accountable for their actions, you know, versus the very real thing of coercion?
Yeah. And I think starting with that case is a great jumping off point. State v. Defendant. It resulted in a conviction for insurance fraud conspiracy.
Yeah.
And the defendant in the case was a chiropractor who tried to defend his actions by claiming he was under duress when he signed this false medical report.
Interesting. So we've got, you know, a chiropractor signing off on a medical report that wasn't legit. That's the act.
Right.
But he's saying he was forced to.
Right.
And here's where it gets tricky. So the legal question that the court was trying to figure out was basically, can you use the duress defense? Can that be successful if there's a lot of time between when the threat was made and when you committed the crime?
Yeah.
And in this case, we're talking about 48 hours, so two full days, between when the threat supposedly happened and when the defendant did the thing he was accused of.
Yeah, and I mean, that 48-hour period is going to be central to how the court ultimately decided this case. To understand why it's so important, we need to dig into the legal principle of duress a little bit, because, you know, it's not just a get out of jail free card for anyone who says they felt pressured to do something. The law really emphasizes this idea of imminent threats. And also it looks at whether someone had a reasonable chance to escape the situation where they were being pressured.
So, I mean, just to be clear, imminent doesn't just mean you're worried something might happen in the future, right?
Exactly. Yeah. New Jersey law says these threats have to be present, imminent, and impending. So it really has to be like right now, about to happen, no other option.
Okay, that makes sense. So let's talk about the facts of this specific case. So we've got this chiropractor. He's caught up in this insurance fraud scheme. And his role is basically signing this medical report for a patient he never even saw.
Right.
And then he claims he was threatened by this guy, Billy Leonardo.
Right. And according to the defendant, these threats, they actually came in a series of three phone calls.
Ah.
And it was that last call, that final threat, the one where Leonardo specifically told him, hey, you got to submit this fraudulent report that happened on a Friday.
Friday.
But he doesn't actually deliver that report until Sunday.
So Sunday. Okay, so that two-day gap is really what the court zoomed in on.
Exactly.
So why was that time difference, that 48 hours, so important in how the court decided this case?
Well, the court basically said that those 2 days, that time, really chipped away at the whole idea of an imminent threat. They pointed out that he had time. He had offered opportunities to do something else.
Yeah.
He could have called the cops. He could have refused to sign the report. The court even said that there was no well-grounded fear during that time because he had the freedom to act.
Right. So it's not just time passing is what he could have done during that time.
Exactly.
Okay, that makes sense. So this brings us to the legal test that courts use when they're looking at a duress defense. There are three parts to it. And the first one is immediacy, which we've already talked about.
Yeah.
You know, the threat has to be happening right when the crime is committed.
Right.
The second part is severity, meaning the defendant has to be legitimately scared, like of death or really serious harm.
Right.
And then the last part is that there has to be no reasonable opportunity to escape, meaning there was no realistic way for them to avoid doing the crime.
Right.
So in this case, where did the defendant's argument fall short?
Well, the court said that because of that 48-hour gap, he couldn't really say the threat was immediate, right? Mm-hmm. So he fails that first part of the test. And then, because he had that time to, you know, reach out for help or just say no, he also doesn't meet that no reasonable opportunity to escape part. So he fails that third part too. The court even suggested that any reasonable person would have done something in those 2 days. And that, you know, that raises a really interesting question for legal theory. Like, how do you account for, you know, how resilient someone is or what they've been through that might affect whether they reach out for help even when there's a delay? I mean, the law tries to have these objective standards, but fear isn't always objective.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And it really highlights the tension between having clear rules and recognizing that everyone experiences threats differently. So what about those situations where someone might genuinely be scared, but the threat isn't literally happening at the exact moment they do whatever it is they're accused of? Does the law have any wiggle room there?
Yeah, this is where things get a bit nuanced. The court in State v. Defendant, they were really sticking to a very strict, you know, old school interpretation of duress. But there are legal experts who take a more flexible view. Even though this court stuck to these really rigid standards, and they were probably doing that to prevent people from just using duress as an excuse after the fact, they did seem to say that if the threat was really, really bad, maybe they might be more flexible about the whole imminence thing in future cases. And it's not just about, you know, physical impossibility when they talk about escaping. They're also thinking about whether a reasonable person would have seen an alternative and felt like they could act on it, even if there was some risk involved. So, for example, maybe the defendant was genuinely afraid that calling the police would put him or his family in more danger.
So basically, the court's trying to find a balance between having these hard and fast rules and recognizing that coercion in the real world is, well, messy.
Exactly. I mean, they don't want anyone to think they can just do something illegal and then claim they were pressured into it. So they're going to have these strict guidelines. But they also seem to acknowledge that sometimes, even if a threat isn't immediate, it could be so scary that it basically overwhelms someone's ability to make their own choices. Imagine someone's told that if they don't do something illegal next week, their family will be hurt. Under how this court is interpreting things, that wouldn't be immediate enough for a duress defense, even though it's terrifying.
Right. Are there any specific phrases in the case that really illustrate these legal ideas?
Yeah, actually, there are two that stand out to me. The first is that the compulsion must induce a well-grounded apprehension of death. So that really shows you how scared someone has to be for the law to take it seriously. And then there's this other part where they say rigid standards prevent shielding oneself from prosecution by mere threats. So that gets at the idea that they don't want people just throwing around the duress defense as a loophole.
That makes sense. So for our law students listening, what's the takeaway here? Why should they care about this case?
Well, I think this case shows you just how important the timing of a threat is and how strict the court is about this whole imminence thing. At least in this jurisdiction. It gives you a look into how courts try to balance justice and fairness with the fact that sometimes people are forced to do things they wouldn't normally do.
Right.
So it's not enough to just say you were threatened. They're going to look really closely at the circumstances, especially how immediate the threat was and what options you had.
Yeah, great point. So just to sum up for everyone, when it comes to duress, timing is key. Even if a threat is really serious, if you had a chance to do something else, like call for help or just refuse to do what you were being pressured to do, the duress defense probably won't work.
Exactly. And I think this case really highlights that traditional strict way of looking at duress,
yeah,
with the imminence requirement at the center of it all.
And that brings us to a final thought. These rules are meant to prevent people from faking duress, right? But what if someone is genuinely threatened, but the threat isn't about to happen right that second? Should that still be a valid defense? It really makes you think about how tough it can be to apply legal principles to real life situations.
Definitely. And like we mentioned earlier, we could do future deep dives into other ways of looking at duress, like how the model penal code approaches it. It gives you another perspective on these really tough legal issues.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Until next time.
See you then.